love's always flow. Your place for music plus more. Just groove and let it go.
Let's unpack this. Jazz, you know, it's far more than just a musical genre.
No, absolutely.
It's like a movement, an attitude, really a profound mirror of cultural evolution. From its fiery birth in New Orleans, right up to its global influence today, it tells a truly extraordinary story.
And what's especially compelling here, I think, is how jazz truly stands as America's original soundtrack.
Yeah.
You know, born from this really dynamic collision of cultures and experiences.
Right.
So today, we're embarking on a deep dive into the rich, often mysterious, history of this music.
And we've got some powerful source material to guide us through this. There's a comprehensive history from G. Ray Records, which kind of lays out the timeline.
Yeah, the big picture stuff.
And then an in-depth exploration into the very genesis of jazz from Andy Edwards, diving deep into its often undocumented, really complex origins.
Which is fascinating territory.
So our mission, to distill the most important nuggets of knowledge, really grasp how this gumbo of sound came to be, and maybe uncover why it remains so vital today. Prepare for some surprising facts, and maybe some genuine aha moments, because I think you're about to discover some truly compelling insights here.
Okay, so if we connect this to the bigger picture, the absolute beginnings of jazz are, well, they're largely shrouded in mystery.
Right, before the recording.
Exactly. Before that first notable recording in 1917, you know, the original Dixieland jazz band's Livery Stable Blues, we have almost no concrete idea what early jazz truly sounded like, or even where the word jazz itself came from. It just sort of appeared.
So that raises a huge question then. How did this foundational American music truly begin?
Yeah.
And what does that mean for its widely acknowledged birthplace? New Orleans is always cited as the cradle of jazz, but why New Orleans specifically? What was going on there?
Well, New Orleans was just this unique place, a port city, a post-Civil War melting pot where different races, cultures, beliefs, creeds, they actively collided. It wasn't always easy.
I can imagine.
You had this negotiation between groups striving to create, you know, a new America with equal rights and others trying desperately to maintain segregation. That tension that basically added the fuel to the fire that sparked jazz.
Wow. That sounds like an incredibly potent environment. So, okay, what exactly was jazz made out of then? What were those early influences swirling around in this melting pot you described?
It was an absolutely extraordinary fusion of elements. I mean, really unique.
Like what?
Okay, so on one hand, you have these powerful African-American influences. Think of plantation work songs and spirituals.
Right.
Like Jordan Roll, you know, from that 1865 book, Slave Songs of the United States. And the blues, which emerged at the exact same time as jazz. You just can't separate them.
Inseparable.
Totally. You hear the rhythmical singing and the call and response patterns, the rhythmic drums, and that distinctive vocalization singing in a really conversational way with slurs, bending notes, adding personality.
Kind of like talking through the instrument.
Precisely. And there's the tradition of talking drums, these incredibly complex cross rhythms and syncopation. This music, it really emphasizes rhythm and time over traditional Western ideas of pitch, harmony, melody.
Okay.
Plus what's sometimes called dirty vocalization, flexible, pungent timbres, growls, scoops, just a general irreverence that brought this raw feeling to the sound.
And the scales.
The pentatonic scale, yeah, that five-note scale with its blue notes, the slightly flattened notes that create that soulful, mournful, yet somehow joyful sound that's key.
Absolutely.
And it crucially, there's this concept of music of the head playing in improvisationally, you know, without written scores, just feeling it.
Right, making it up on the spot.
Mm-hmm. And finally, rhythmic repetition, building excitement like in, say, voodoo ceremonies or ring chants, along with catchy phrases and breaks that allowed for individual musicians to show off their virtuosity.
That African-American experience.
It provided, the fire within jazz, its dark soul, as one source puts it, the suffering, the resilience, it's all in there.
Yeah, okay, so that's one major pillar. And on the other side of that equation, what about the European contributions to this evolving sound?
Right, because it wasn't just one thing. From white European influences, jazz definitely adopted Western intonation, functional harmony, discipline, and technical proficiency. Often this came from classical training, like you'd find in French conservatories.
So formal training met improvisation.
Exactly. And the very idea of a virtuoso solo performance, that also has roots in the European tradition. Elements like British folk songs, popular parlor songs, even evangelical church hymns, they all subtly found their way into the mix.
Interesting.
And the actual instruments and arrangements in early jazz largely came from Europe. Specifically from military units, their instruments became readily available, cheap to buy, after the Civil War around 1865.
Ah, okay. That makes sense.
And it's quite interesting, actually. When people first heard spirituals back in the 19th century, they often said they sounded like Irish folk songs. Yeah, and a famous tune like St. James Infirmary, which everyone associates with jazz. It was originally an Irish folk song.
No kidding. So it truly was a blend, not just of two, but multiple cultures. Were there other distinct American influences at play that helped shape this new sound? Things unique to the U.S.?
Oh, absolutely. You can't ignore minstrel shows. Now, they were a deeply racist and prejudiced form of entertainment in the 19th century.
Right, problematic history there.
Very. But they were the most popular entertainment of their time, and they developed songs and performance approaches that, well, undeniably influenced early jazz, no getting around it.
Okay.
Then you had spasm bands emerging in New Orleans around 1890, often just young street kids making their own instruments, cigar box banjos, tub basses, gas pipe bugles,
wow.
And they'd mimic the marching bands, playing totally by ear. The Razzle Dazzy Spasm Band, formed by white youngsters in 1895, was famous for this raw, improvised style. Totally. And don't forget the cakewalk. This predates 1865, where slaves would parody white elites through their dancing. That directly contributed to jazz's inherent swagger and syncopation.
The movement aspect.
Mm-hmm. And finally, marches. Especially John Philip Sousa marches. They were incredibly popular in New Orleans. If you take those marches and you infuse them with the rhythmic feel of ragtime, well, you're really hearing the embryonic beginnings of jazz right there.
The putting it all together.
When you look at it all, jazz is unequivocally the product of integration. It was almost a miracle, really, at a time when genuine integration was so rare.
Yeah.
It embodies these ideals of equality and racial harmony, almost like a fluid conversation between a multitude of different influences.
This brings us to a particularly fascinating and, yeah, sometimes complicated aspect of New Orleans social fabric.
Mm-hmm.
The racial landscape. And specifically, the pivotal role of the Creoles. How did this unique societal structure influence the music so profoundly?
Right, the Creole situation is key. New Orleans society before the Civil War was typically structured in three tiers.
Yeah.
You had whites, then mixed descent Creoles who were largely free, often educated, but frequently not granted the same respect as whites.
The kind of in-between status.
Exactly. And then African Americans, which included both ex-slaves and free blacks. Now, Creoles often saw themselves as more cultured and frequently had conservatory training in music.
Okay.
But after the Civil War, things changed drastically. New Orleans society sort of collapsed into a more rigid, two-tier white and black society.
How did that happen?
Well, it was intensified by things like the 1865 Louisiana Black Code and then the 1890 law mandating separate rail car accommodations, which infamously led to the Plessy v. Ferguson Supreme Court case in 1896.
Separate but equal.
Mm-mm.
Which wasn't equal at all.
Not at all. It enforced widespread Jim Crow segregation. And this forced groups together who had previously seen themselves as quite separate.
So the Creoles were pushed closer to the black community.
Essentially, yes. And many of the true geniuses who created early jazz were Creoles of color. People like Sidney Bechet, Jelly Roll Morton, Manuel Perez, members of the Teo family. Incredible musicians.
Mm.
As Jim Crow laws increasingly pushed Creoles out of the more formal orchestras and reading marching bands, they had to seek work on the black circuit.
Okay.
And there, they blended their highly developed musical skills, their reading ability, their technique, with the raw improvisational traditions of the former slaves. That convergence, it had an absolutely profound impact on how jazz developed.
Wow. Okay, so when we delve into those earliest days of jazz, names like Buddy Bolden often come up. Is he truly the singular inventor, as some history suggests, or that may be a bit of a simplification?
That's a great question, and yeah, it's where the historical record gets really nuanced and fascinating. Buddy Bolden is frequently cited as the virtual inventor, right? It's a powerful narrative.
Yeah, the legend.
But our sources, particularly the Edwards material, reveal he actually joined an already established jazz group run by a guy named Charlie Galloway, which started around 1895.
Ah, okay, so not the absolute beginning.
Right, incredibly influential, no doubt. But many early bands existed before him. For instance, the Excelsior Brass Band, formed way back in 1879.
Wow, that early.
Yeah, it was one of the earliest recognized brass bands and included both black and Creole musicians like Theophile Baquet, Lorenzo Tio, and Louis Cottrell Sr., who one source calls an actual architect of jazz drumming. Hmm. The Onward Brass Band, formed 1884, also included giants like Joe Oliver and Manuel Perez, so the roots go deep.
And what about white bands early on?
Definitely playing a role too. Papa Jack Lane's Reliance Band, formed in 1892, was probably the most famous early white band. And interestingly, it primarily played head arrangements.
Meaning improvised.
Yeah, mostly improvised. Apparently only one member could even read music. And despite Lane supposedly trying to keep his band all white, some light-skinned black and Creole musicians did play in his band, simply because that's where the money and the gigs were. Shows you the practicality sometimes override ideology.
Right.
And you also see white musicians like Emil Lum from that Razzle Dazzy Spasm band we mentioned, who couldn't read music and improvised, even claiming he invented jazz. Lots of claims floating around.
Huh. Seems like everyone wanted credit. You mentioned the Tio family again just now, those Creole musicians. How specifically did they contribute to this developing form?
Right. The Tios are crucial for understanding that blend. Lorenzo Tio Sr. Jr. and their uncle Louis Papa Tio, who actually immigrated from Spain.
From Spain, okay.
Yeah. They were instrumental in bridging European classical technique with emerging jazz. They brought specific methods like the Albert system, that's a particular fingering system for clarinets, and the double lip embouchure, a brass playing technique, directly into the, you know, the early jazz tradition.
So formal technique mixing with the feel.
Exactly. Lorenzo Tio Jr., for example, notably taught giants like Sidney Bechet. That shows a really clear, direct integration between rigorous classical training and the emerging, more spontaneous jazz approach.
That's fascinating.
So the key takeaway here, I think, and it's a powerful one, is that there was never a point in history where only one race was playing this music. Jazz is the tangible result of cooperation and integration between white, Creole, and black groups.
Despite the segregation surrounding.
Exactly. It was a cooperation of diverse creative individuals, people genuinely open to ideas from other cultures, even within a highly segregated system. And you could argue that this inherent fight against segregation became an almost underlying message, a core principle of jazz itself.
That story of integration, especially in that context, is incredibly compelling.
Yeah.
So this music then just exploded into the mainstream during the jazz age of the 1920s and 30s. What was the broader cultural context for this rebellion in rhythm, as one source called it? How did jazz become its soundtrack?
Yeah, the Roaring Twenties. It was a time of massive change, rapid urbanization, economic growth, this palpable sense of social liberation after the trauma of World War I.
A release, maybe?
Definitely a release. Women gained the right to vote. Prohibition, ironically, created this thriving underground nightlife where jazz flourished.
Speakeasies and all that.
Exactly. And the Great Migration brought Southern black culture and its music to northern cities like Chicago and New York. Harlem became the absolute epicenter of a black cultural revival, the Harlem Renaissance, and jazz was completely inseparable from that.
And musically. Who are the key figures then?
Giants emerged. Louis Armstrong.
All right.
He completely transformed jazz into a soloist's art form. His fearless improvisation, his charisma, was listened to West End blues, game-changing.
A true icon.
Absolutely. And Duke Ellington, in parallel, elevated jazz to high art, a master composer, a bandleader. Pieces like Mood Indigo showed jazz could be complex, orchestral, sophisticated.
So it was evolving rapidly.
Constantly. Jazz thrived on collective improvisation, that syncopation, those blue notes we talked about, blurring the lines between written composition and spontaneous expression.
But it wasn't universally loved, right?
No, definitely not. As a social rebellion, well, to many conservatives, jazz symbolized everything unruly and indecent. interracial bands, late-night decadence, breaking old social norms. It was scandalous to some.
The devil's music, some call it.
Pretty much. But to others, particularly young people, it represented pure freedom. It really became America's very first youth-driven counterculture.
And technology played a role, too.
Huge role. The rapid rise of radio and phonograph records made jazz the first truly mass-consumed genre of popular music. Artists like Armstrong and Ellington quickly became household names, celebrities. And Hollywood caught on immediately. 1927's The Jazz Singer, the first talkie, used jazz to signal modernity, reflecting its cultural dominance.
And as this music gained momentum, it then evolved again, didn't it, into the massive swing and big band era in the 1930s and 40s.
Indeed. Swing became almost synonymous with joy and, importantly, a vital form of escape during the really tough times of the Great Depression and then World War II.
Dancing music.
Absolutely. It packed ballrooms with these huge bands led by icons like Count Basie, Benny Goodman, Glenn Miller, household names. Arrangers like Fletcher Henderson fundamentally evolved jazz's structural complexity, making it work for these large ensembles.
And it crossed racial lines, too.
Significantly. Benny Goodman's integrated band was a major breakthrough. Swing became a beacon of racial integration, however imperfect, and remarkably, a symbol of American identity on the global stage during the war.
It sounds like recordings were absolutely central to this explosion into the mainstream. You mentioned the ODJB record earlier. When did jazz truly solidify as a genre in the way we understand it today, driven by these new technologies?
Yeah, that commercial viability was key. The original Dixieland Jazz Band's recording of Livery Stable Blues in 1917, selling a million records back then. That was astonishing.
Unheard of.
Right, and it spurred record companies to actively seek out more music like that. That process really began to codify the genre, give it boundaries, a name that stuck.
You mentioned earlier these ODJB guys weren't just copying black musicians.
No, and that's an important point from the Edwards source. They weren't simply white wannabes. They had been deeply embedded in the New Orleans scene since around 1905, assimilating music from all corners, black, Creole, marches, blues, everything. Louis Armstrong himself, a true luminary, famously called them the first great jazz orchestra. High praise.
So the history is more intertwined than sometimes portrayed.
Much more. Now, there were earlier attempts at recording or things close to jazz. Freddie Keppard, a prominent black trumpeter, he famously refused to record early on because he was afraid people would steal his style, which tells you something about how unique and valuable individual improvisation was considered even then.
Wow.
But other early contenders existed. You had ragtime piano rolls by Lucky Roberts in 1913, James Reese Europe's black marching music from 1913-14, which swung but maybe wasn't quite jazz. Charles Prince's band recorded W.C. Handy's Memphis Blues in 1914, Wilbur Sweatman's Mixed Race Group recorded in 1916, and the Six Brown Brothers, white performers, but performing in blackface, complicating things, also recorded in 1916. So the ODJB wasn't the very first sound vaguely like jazz recorded, but theirs was the hit that defined the genre for the market.
Okay. And the recording technology itself, did that shape the music?
Absolutely. That's a fascinating point. Early jazz artists uniquely utilized the recording medium itself as an artistic tool. It wasn't just about capturing a live performance.
Not so.
They incorporated sound effects like the animal noises on Livery Stable Blues voiceovers. They told little sonic stories within the 3-minute limit of a 78 RPM record, almost like miniature progressive rock records, decades before prog rock.
That's a great comparison.
And when giants like Louis Armstrong and Jelly Roll Morton entered studios in the 1920s, they weren't just documenting their usual gigs, they were assembling bands specifically to make recordings, masterfully using the limitations and possibilities of the new medium to define a song's structure, create a distinct instrumental sound for the record. Jazz was arguably the first music style to fully leverage recording as a fundamental artistic component, not just documentation.
So jazz had gone mainstream, captivated audiences worldwide through records and radio. But it didn't just settle there and become static, did it? It kept evolving, sometimes in surprising, you know, even underground ways, constantly pushing boundaries.
Oh, not at all. It never stood still. As popular tastes changed, you know, rock and roll starting its ascent in the 50s, jazz continued to defiantly push boundaries. It splintered. Well, from the 1940s into the 1960s, you had these rebels like Charlie Parker, Thelonious Monk, Dizzy Gillespie creating bebop.
Right, much more complex.
Totally. Shattering the danceability of swing with rapid tempos, intricate harmonies, really intense improvisational fire. It was music for listening, primarily.
Yeah.
And parallel, you had Miles Davis. His album, Kind of Blue, basically ushered in modal jazz, this looser, more atmospheric, open approach to harmony. Huge influence.
Iconic album.
Absolutely. And alongside him, people like John Coltrane, Ornette Coleman, they pushed modal and then free jazz into deeply spiritual, sometimes really uncharted harmonic territories. Challenging stuff.
And this wasn't always happening in the big famous clubs.
No, not always. In the 1960s, for instance, this club in the Lower East Side called Slugs became this like crucible for raw, unfettered genius.
Slugs, never heard of it.
Yeah, maybe less famous now, but legendary at the time. Musicians like Lee Morgan, McCoy Tyner, they played fiercely experimental, often unrecorded music there that purposefully defied commercial trends. It was intense.
Unrecorded. So how do we know about it?
Well, some recordings have surfaced. A recently unearthed 1966 live recording by the great drummer Jack DeJohnette powerfully demonstrates how profound and unfiltered this deeply improvisational spiritual scene truly was. It's amazing stuff.
Wow.
Now there's a tragic side too. Lee Morgan's story. He went from stardom to addiction and was actually murdered at Slugs. A really dark chapter.
Oh, wow.
But despite that tragedy, the aesthetic and the spiritual intensity of that slug scene, it continues to inspire musicians today and is now rightfully considered part of the jazz canon in education. It represents that edge.
So jazz kept fragmenting and exploring. What happened after that period of intense experimentation? How did it continue to reshape itself into the diverse sounds we hear today?
Well, it kept blending. Jazz famously embraced electricity without flinching, which led to movements like fusion and funk and its further expansion onto the global stage from the 70s through the 90s.
Fusion, like jazz rock.
Exactly. Artists like Herbie Hancock with Headhunters, Weather Report, Pat Metheny. They seamlessly blended funk, rock, and these vibrant world rhythms into their jazz framework.
And the global aspect.
Yeah, Latin jazz continued to evolve. You had Afrobeat from trailblazers like Fela Kuti in Nigeria, heavily influenced by jazz funk. Various European styles gave jazz a genuinely global pulse. It became less purely American.
And then more recently, what's happening now?
In the era of modern jazz, say from the 2000s to today, you have these contemporary giants, people like Esperanza Spalding, Kamasi Washington, Robert Glasper.
Heard of them, yeah.
They're actively reshaping what jazz means. They're blending it with hip hop, classical music, electronic elements. They're sampling the past, reimagining it. It's still very much alive and evolving.
So, okay, bring this all together. What's the lasting significance here for us? Jazz isn't just history locked in a museum. You're saying it's a living, breathing conversation. What, in your view, is the core essence, the thread, that has allowed it to endure and constantly reinvent itself across so many decades and styles?
That's the big question, isn't it? I don't think jazz is a straight line at all. It's more like an ever-expanding web of improvisations, always riffing on its past while simultaneously inventing its future. It's often the music of creatives, people who are, in some way, outsiders. Think about musicians like Louis Armstrong and the white cornetist Bix Beiderbecke. Despite the oppressive Jim Crow laws of their time, they'd famously find ways to sit and play together. Why? Because they simply loved each other's playing.
The music brought them together.
Exactly. It's a powerful testament that creativity can, and maybe should, fundamentally transcend race and identity politics. Jazz embodies those ideals of equality, bringing genuinely different people together through sound. It's absolutely not a separatist music form, despite being born from specific cultural experiences.
But that experience is still crucial.
Oh, undoubtedly. The X factor, you have to say, is the African-American experience, particularly the legacy of slavery.
Yeah.
That immense suffering, that resilience. It acts as a fire within jazz, its soul, as we said, that's undeniable. But it's equally the product of integration, that complex gumbo of all Americans, where Black creative individuals undeniably made the most profound and lasting statements. Ultimately, I think jazz is fundamentally about people coming together. It's about communication, about love, maybe, and about finding common ground through shared artistic expression.
What an extraordinary journey. Seriously. Through time, through sound, we've gone from those, you know, back alley clubs and street bands in New Orleans to grand symphony halls and global stages, truly witnessing how jazz constantly, constantly reinvents itself.
And through every single phase, every change, it has always, always found a way to swing in its own way.
Yeah.
This deep dive, I hope, has shown us that jazz, born from this really complex and often painful history of segregation and suffering, paradoxically became one of the most powerful examples of unity and love through creative collaboration. It really is a compelling testament to what happens when people genuinely come together.
So, what might this all mean for you, listening right now? Maybe the next time you hear a jazz tune, any kind of jazz tune, remember its intricate layers, the history behind it, the pain, the celebration, the relentless innovation, and that incredible, almost miraculous blend of cultures that forged it.
Mm-hmm. And maybe here's a final provocative thought for you to consider, just to mull over. In a world that's still, let's face it, grappling with division and identity, how can the enduring spirit of jazz, this music, born from the deepest forms of human experience, forged through radical integration, how can that spirit continue to inspire us to find common ground, celebrate our collective humanity, both in art and maybe more importantly in life?
Something to think about.
Definitely something to think about.
Hi, this is Naomi, a spokesperson for the G-Ray Records Music Network. Big thanks to everyone for tuning in and listening to G-Ray Records, your place for music plus more. May peace be with you.